So I wanted to begin by just saying how amazing it is to walk into this hall. And particularly when everyone is back in, it feels very beautiful to be here all together. And sometimes quite difficult to actually speak into this very powerful silence. So please forgive me for speaking anyway into it. A few years ago, I was invited by the peace and justice group in our little town in Dorset, UK, to speak about our work in Palestine. And when they sent me the invitation that they'd sent out, it read something like, we've invited Zohar to speak to us about how growing up in Israel inspired her to support the Palestinian cause, something like that. And I remember thinking, ah, that's really interesting. That's a really interesting question, actually. Like, what was it about my life, the way I grew up, that kind of inspired what I do and the work of Palestine and Palestine just being a part of it. So I really took it as an opportunity to reflect, to really kind of reflect back on my life in a very non-mental way. So not trying to figure out, but just letting myself sink back into the past. And I got all the way back to my grandfather and my relationship with him as a young child. And it became very clear that his kindness had somehow started something very deep within me. And particularly, he was a very, very, very observant religious Jew, really observant, you know, with the hat and the coat and that kind of thing. But particularly his attitude towards the rules of that religion when it came to his relationship with us, with his grandchildren, which was always that there's something more important than the rules. And he used to always bend the rules when it came to us. If we wanted something that wasn't quite, you know, it wasn't quite the time yet, or it wasn't quite the right thing to do on a Sabbath, he would always encourage us to do it. So it was that kind of kindness, that kind of connection to what is more important than rules or ideas. And he passed away when I was 11. And as I was growing up, I became exposed to other parts of his personality. So as I was growing up and I was older, my grandmother and my parents, it came out that he was also a very difficult man. And that his wife and his kids had also suffered from his behavior. And so my question today, my question for this talk is, how do these things sit together? Is the kindness I knew erased by the harshness my father knew? Is the harshness my father knew erased by the kindness I knew? Or is it possible that they're equally true, equally real? That certain situations, certain conditions allow certain manifestations of life, of who we are. And when I reflect on the stories from my grandmother and my father, I know that their experience was real. But when I feel within me, I also know that mine was, and that that kindness was really there. And so, it feels like this is kind of an uncomfortable truth, but one that is really worth exploring and looking at in our lives. The way that what we see as reality, what we see as truth, has more dimensions than we usually give it credit for. And I often have this image that in our everyday way of looking at life, it's very one-dimensional. It's like a comic a lot of the time. You know, just one thing, okay, I'm like this, that person is like that, this situation is this way. And this is very useful. I don't want to kind of put it down in any way. It's very useful, particularly when we need to act in the world, when we need to make decisions, and we're moving fast. So this is useful. You know, we need to see something and know what it is and know what's appropriate and act. But as we give more time to what we're doing here, when we kind of slow down, when we look at our experience more intimately, we can start seeing these seeming contradictions, or if we say it in a more positive way, the richness of life, the richness of ourselves, the richness of life around us, the fact that there's so many textures and colors to experience and to human beings and to situations, not just one. And I really had this image today of really, when we really look at a simple object like this, there's so much in it. There's the color, there's the way the texture changes, the way the folds create light and shadow. So there's depth and there's hidden aspects that aren't always obvious to us in the first contact that we have. And with that, we can begin to see how nothing exists just on its own. Nothing is actually set, solid, and separate. Everything is made up of everything else. Nothing is just one thing. No person is just one quality or one characteristic. And this can also kind of be flipped around. And I'd like to share another story from Jarvis, the prisoner that I was talking about last time in San Quentin. And so the story goes that he was sitting in his room one evening, and he was reading, but he was, like a lot of us, multitasking. So he also had the TV on with the sound off. So he was reading by the light of the television, and once in a while he would look up at the screen just to see what was going on. It was a news program. And because the sound was off, he didn't really understand every time what was happening, so he would shout out to the other prisoners along the row, asking, what are they showing on the television now? So, you know, he sees a bunch of people on the screen, and he shouts out, what's the story about? And they say, that's the Ku Klux Klan demonstrating and, you know, voicing their view about all the problems that the Jews and the blacks are causing in the world and whatever. And then he goes back to reading, and after some more time, he looks up again, and there's a bunch of people in suits in a room all arguing, and he's shouting to his friends, well, what's the story about now? And they say, that's the Senate, and they're having some big debate about some, you know, economical issues. And so he goes back to reading his book, and after a little bit more time, he looks up again, and he sees a bunch of demonstrators, kind of hippie-looking, and he shouts out to them, what's the story now? And they say, that's a bunch of Greenpeace activists demonstrating against the destruction of the planet. And at this point, Jarvis just starts laughing, and he shouts out to his friends, you know, you can turn the TV off now, I've kind of figured it out. And he says, it doesn't seem to matter if these are racists or environmentalists or people in suits who've been elected to represent all of us. You know, they're all just angry faces. They've all got the same angry faces. And so in a way, this is like the flip side of our reality, where we think we're different. We think we're right and someone else is wrong. Or that we're like this and not like that. But actually, the essence, the embodiment is the same. It's separateness. It's the sense of, I'm this and you're that. And I'm right and you're wrong. So not just looking at labels or ideas, but actually at what is underlying that, what is internally going on inside. So as we gradually go into ourselves, as we open to life and embrace this process of unfolding and uncovering what makes up this human experience that's living through this body, this mind right now, we see more and more of these things. We can become more sensitive. We become more sensitive to the discomfort of this separateness. We feel more the uncertainty, the fact that the more we look, the more we find that there's actually nothing to stand on. Nothing to be sure of. I don't know why I'm smiling at that. And it can be painful, and it can be confusing. Because the edges blur, which is very beautiful, but also can be quite disconcerting when we can't place ourselves somewhere solid. When we start to question what's black and what's white, what's right and what's wrong. When we open to more possibilities. And we somehow lose the ease of just labeling something and forgetting about it. You know, that's just a bad person, or that's just a bad place, or that's just not my thing. Because actually, we've heard this message of, let's look at life, let's be interested, let's explore. And so sometimes I have this image that it all becomes a lot more messy. And maybe that doesn't quite align itself with this talk about clarity and all of that. But in the clarity, we see the mess. Also, the way everything seems to be connected and meshed together. But it's also very alive. Very, very alive, this mess of life. And it offers us a lot of possibility. A lot more possibility. So I'm going to keep going with this, and hopefully I'll make some sense at some point. We'll see. So about, I guess about 5 or 6 weeks ago, when we were in Palestine, we were harvesting olives. Another day, not the same day I spoke about before, with a different family. And the farmer we were working with had told us that quite often soldiers were coming by and telling him that he wasn't allowed to be where he was. He was very, very close to a settlement right by the fence. But it happened to be that actually he was allowed to be there. That was just the reality of the situation. So we were harvesting olives. And under this very, very amazing large tree with quite an extended family, a grandma and an 80-year-old grandpa and the son and his wife and the kids and a couple of other volunteers. And then someone who was up in the tree said, the soldiers are coming. And so we then kind of started to look around and we saw them approaching. And so here we were, a Palestinian family who really relies, in their case, extremely on this work for their income. A bunch of volunteers. And then three soldiers walking over in complete combat gear, camouflage and everything, lots of heavy gear. And I could see then, and I can even see it more clearly now in reflection, how many different realities were going on in the same place. So for the soldiers, the reality is that they're in a war zone. That's their reality. They're scared. They're protecting themselves. And they have a job to do. And they want to do that job, as most of us tend to do, with as least hassle to themselves. You know, as quickly and as easily and as stress-free for themselves. That's their narrative. And here's a Palestinian family that's somewhere where they shouldn't be. Because it can't be that they're allowed to work so close to the fence of the settlement. So that's their narrative. And for the Palestinians, this is their land, this is their livelihood. They need to finish the harvest. And these soldiers are in their way. And, you know, they're ready to do what they need to do to finish the harvest, which probably means if the soldiers tell them to go, to say yes, yes, and go off in one direction, and when the soldiers disappear, come back. And that's their narrative. And then we as volunteers have a third. You know, we're kind of looking at, you know, we're there to help, but we're harvesting for a minute, and then we're facing soldiers the next, and we can't get our heads around the complexity of the situation. So there's these different, completely different narratives happening in the same situation in just a very short period of time. And when we look clearly, at least when I look clearly, with my own clarity, each narrative is true for the person that's living it. It's their reality. It doesn't matter what my opinion or view is about it. That's not relevant at that point. That's their reality. And yet they're all living together. They're there at the same time, these different narratives, and obviously they can clash. So what happens next? So the soldier says to the farmer, the officer of the three, says to the farmer, you can't be here. And the farmer says, well, you know, why not? And then I step over and I say hello in Hebrew. And the soldier says to me, do you realize you're not allowed to be here? And I say to him, actually, no, I didn't realize we're not allowed to be here. Are you sure? So, there's an element of uncertainty coming into the narratives. Are you sure? And I pick up my phone and I phone my contacts in one of the NGOs who have all the information. And so this officer sees me do that, and so he says, okay, I'll check. And so he uses his communication device to phone and ask, are they allowed to be there or not? And he's told, we'll check and we'll let you know. So we all end up staying there for a while, waiting for the response. So we're spending some time, and the soldiers are standing on one side, and the family has moved back to further tree, further away. We're kind of in the middle. And we're waiting, and after some time, the officer turns to me and he says, you know, you don't need to stop working. You may as well carry on working until we get the response. And I look around, and I say to him, you know, that's kind of hard for us because we're pretty shaken up. So suddenly, our narratives can meet. We're communicating. And he says, ah, you don't need to be shaken up. There's no reason for you to be shaken up. And I say, yeah, but we are. So we meet. And so the reason I've told this long story is not to play some trick and disturb your quiet mind, but because I feel it gives a really good example of what can happen in these situations. So we meet, we get to a place where one narrative is different than another. And in our conditioned way, we would run away from that discomfort, just like the soldiers. You can't be here, get out, and off we go, we carry on with the patrol. But when something happens, and we spend time in that place of discomfort, we have to wait. And then we start seeing. And then naturally, a kindness comes up, a human kindness response arises. You don't need to stop, you can carry on working. I see you. You're a human being again. I see your needs. And there's a meeting. And for a while, somehow the narratives meet. They come together. So the longer we spend in these kind of places of discomfort with the way life is, with the complexity of life, the more likely it is that we can see a wider picture, not just my own limited view, but something bigger. And that naturally leads to a movement that will bridge that gap. Even more, that will connect, that will eventually, inshallah, as they say in Palestine, will heal separation. Will heal separation. And it feels like it's really inevitable. It's like a magnetic force. It's something that happens. If we just stay there, sometimes even unintentionally, not necessarily having that intention. And then, just to end with this story, eventually the response came back that, yeah, the farmers were allowed to be there. And the soldiers passed on the message and went on with their patrol. And it felt to me like everyone was equally satisfied with that result. Not opposing anymore, but in a way, for a little while, on the same side. Everyone felt happy that the work could carry on, that it didn't need to be interrupted. And I really feel that this movement of kindness that I saw there, of course, is dependent on many, many conditions, but it's also really natural within us that when we have the opportunity to see another person, if we have the opportunity to see someone else's need without being blinded by our own, then we'll naturally move to support. And the same dynamic is also true in our relationships with ourselves. It's not just between myself and the other outside of me. It's also so strong between myself and myself. Parts of me that are not what I think should be there, not what I want to be there. Equally true. And also in our relationships with people that we love, with people that we're close to. We want to figure ourselves out, we want to figure other people out. You're like this, I'm like that. This works, this doesn't work. This is the way to deal with you when you're like that. This is what I want when I'm like this. Which is all true, part of the time. But not all of the time. Not all of the time. Because, again, the more we look at ourselves, the more honest we are about what's going on internally, we see that we have all these different aspects that we're constantly changing, that we can't always know what to expect. Which is sometimes really annoying and sometimes also really fun. A lot of the time, actually. Like, we can't freeze life. We can't make it stay solid and still. It's always moving. It's always changing. And we, as part of life, also. Like, one creative life force that just keeps on showing itself in different ways. And for me personally, I've had a great teacher with Nathan in my life as someone who has almost no memory whatsoever. So he's always changing. And so, like, what do you mean? You know, you feel this when you just, last week you said that, you know? How can that be? Can't you stick to your opinion? And I think it's something that I've really learned to love and appreciate. That part, which was really annoying for a long time and sometimes still is. And equally in myself, I remember not so long ago, maybe about a year, suddenly realizing one day that I'm lazy. And it was a real revelation. It still is. I still get excited by that fact once in a while. You know, just seeing a part of me that I'd never seen before. It was like, wow, I'm lazy. Also, I'm not just that really efficient doer. But I also love just not doing anything. What's there? And I'm really lazy about my practice. Never gonna get enlightened. So we see this in life, and we see this in ourselves, and we see this in our relationships with each other, and we see this so much in our relationship to the path, to our spiritual journey, where we want to figure things out, we want to know, what's this? This voice that I'm hearing, is it my mind? Is it my heart? Is it my ego? Should I listen to it? Should I ignore it? Do I have the choice? It keeps coming up. And part of it, you know, is also, I really don't want to put it down, it's a very healthy love of understanding, of loving the path and wanting to know what's useful. And also the doubt itself is healthy, the questioning. But it's also worth holding lightly and laughing at once in a while. Because most of the time, there's really no way to tell. Am I heading in the right direction or not? And this journey is much more like a dance than like a, you know, hike along a marked path where we see the next sign before we've lost contact with the previous one. It's kind of a few steps forward and a few steps back and a few steps to this side and a few to that. But it all is part of this momentum that's leading us to this unknown destination that we're so dedicatedly journeying towards. And there's so much beauty in this mystery, in the fact that there's so much unknown, and yet so much to discover as well, together. And again, we come back to this groundlessness. Not much to stand on. If at all. Not much to stand on. Not much to hold on to. So as we dance on this path to the unknown, I just suddenly had a flash in my mind of the son of a friend of mine who recently, he's 7, I think, and he recently told me that he wants to be a scientist when he grows up, and he's going to invent a car that can fly, can move in the water, in the air, in the sky. There's something else. I think it was those three. And I just suddenly had a flash of that, and I thought, this is also what our path is. It's not just a path on the ground. It goes through every medium. It touches everything. And so part of this dance is the recognition of how relative everything we know is, that it's limited, and yet it's what we have to work with. And an incredible important aspect of it is the cultivation of the ability to rest with the uncomfortable, which is what we're doing here all the time. We're cultivating this ability to be with what arises, not just for this moment, but so that when things come up in our lives, we have that steadiness. It's something that we can grow within ourselves. Because when we rest in the uncomfortable, when we can stay there, then we open up to that natural kindness and love that can flow through. When we can stay there long enough and not get caught up in our habitual ways of running away. And we can be ready for whatever step unfolds next from the infinite possibilities that exist within each of us and in each moment. So it seems that I've come full circle back to kindness, where at least I remember that this talk began. And I also want to kind of just say that this kindness that I'm speaking about is also not the idea of kindness that we have, or this kind of wishy-washy kind of, everything is okay, necessarily kind of kindness. But a kindness that is alive, that can move appropriately to each situation, that can sometimes say, well, you know, thanks, but I can't just go back to work right now because I'm shaken up. And that's my reality. And can you see that? I heard recently that when Martin Luther King was training the social activists that were working with him, he kept emphasizing that what we're doing is, we're doing this for everyone. The healing that we're seeking is not just for the blacks. We're seeking healing for everyone. So that kind of kindness, that kind of love. And I was also reminded of another grandfather story, not mine. And this is a friend of mine who's a Dharma teacher. And I spent time with him and his grandson. He was about 9. And he joined us on a kind of gathering that we were doing in France. And I think it was the first time he saw his granddad in this position of Dharma teacher. And so he's at an age where he's kind of curious about religion in general and what it means. And he was hearing the words Dharma and Buddha. And so one time he asked his granddad, "So is Dharma your religion?" And his grandfather thought for a while, and then he said, "Actually, my religion is kindness." And that kind of carried on a conversation, a dialogue through the 10 days of the gathering between them. Because that was something he could understand, and he was really interested in. The religion of kindness. And I really feel that's something worth ending with. This idea of what is my religion? What is the thing that I value, that I want to be moved by, and that I want to move towards? Really worth exploring for ourselves what that is. And then in the mysterious way that the universe works, after I wrote my talk today, I had some time, and I thought I'd make some signs for the work retreat that's coming up, in case anyone forgot. And I found amongst the papers from last year a poem that one of the retreatants had given to me. And the title of the poem is Kindness. So I thought I'd share it. And it's by Naomi Shihab Nye. I think I'm pronouncing her name correctly. And the poem is a bit long, but here goes. Before you really know what kindness is, you must lose things. Feel the future dissolve in a moment, like salt in a weakened broth. What you held in your hand, what you counted and carefully saved, all this must go, so you know how desolate the landscape can be between the regions of kindness. How you ride and ride, thinking the bus will never stop. The passengers eating maize and chicken will stare out the window forever. Before you learn the tender gravity of kindness, you must travel where the Indian in a white poncho lies dead by the side of the road. You must see how this could be you, how he too was someone who journeyed through the night with plans and the simple breath that kept him alive. Before you know kindness as the deepest thing inside, you must know sorrow as the other deepest thing. You must wake up with sorrow. You must speak to it till your voice catches the thread of all sorrows and you see the size of the cloth. Then it is only kindness that makes sense anymore. Only kindness that ties your shoes and sends you out into the day to mail letters and purchase bread. Only kindness that raises its head from the crowd of the world to say, "It is I you have been looking for," and then goes with you everywhere, like a shadow or a friend. Only kindness that raises its head from the crowd of the world to say, "It is I you have been looking for," and then goes with you everywhere, like a shadow or a friend. So let's have a couple of quiet minutes to close.